Welcome to Sordid Cinema. This week, Ricky, myself, I'm Simon, and special guest Matt Donato are here to talk about Alice Lowe's slasher comedy satire extravaganza, Prevenge, which she made while she was 7 months pregnant. We're also going to be having a discussion about Ghost in the Shell, whitewashing, and Hollywood culture.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Whatever appears emerges as raw experience for those who watch it.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight.
Hey, you're listening to Sordid Cinema, the Sordid Cinema podcast. My name is Simon Howell. I'm joined by Ricky D.
What's up, Simon?
And this week we're joined by a very special guest from We Got This Covered. It's Matt Donato.
Thanks for having me on the show this week, guys.
This is dope. Let's do it. So, this week, very, very excited to discuss a little movie called Prevenge. Is there any notes, any house cleaning we need to do before we get to that?
No, I don't think so. Matt, when was the last time you were on the show? It was talking about Wes Craven?
That was, my God, wasn't it Shyamalan? Wasn't it like
was
The
it?
Visit? I think it was The Visit, and we went into Shyamalan-y things.
Yeah, well, Matt's one of my favorite guests we've ever had on the podcast, which is saying a lot, because we've been doing it for 10 years. It's kind of a good thing that Ghost in a Shell wasn't very good, because we decided to cancel a review of Ghost in a Shell, because it gave me the chance to watch a really kick-ass movie, which I'm excited to talk about.
You know, we thought about doing Ghost in the Shell, and then I was like, I don't want to pay money for that shit, so we didn't. It's basically how that happened. And also, you told us that it was bad and dumb, and we didn't want to do it. Not that bad and dumb movies shouldn't be talked about, but, you know, eventually you want to get to some cool shit.
No, it's just boring. Just boring.
So, I guess, screw it then. Let's, you know, I keep listening to other podcasts, and there's like 10, 15 minutes of preamble, and it's just the worst, so screw it. Let's just hear a clip and start talking about Alice Lowe's Prevenge.
I'm really sorry about your loss, and I know it's been very difficult for you. And at the end of the day, you've got this force of nature now inside you. Baby knows what to do. Baby will tell you what to do. It's just nature's way.
I think nature's a bit of an arse, though, don't you?
You're getting better at this.
I'm not in control. I don't want to know what's in there. I'm scared of her. I would swap her to have him. Fuck. She can't hear you. She can't. She's very articulate.
Kill him. Or I kill you.
Do you want a drink?
If it's fun you're after, you've come to the right place.
I'm on the dark side. You would not believe what I've been doing recently. Very efficient with that one.
I was wondering if I could talk to you about child charity.
You're insane.
I am a working mother.
Children these days are really spoiled. Like, Mummy, I want a PlayStation. Mummy, I want you to kill that man.
Listen to the sound of my voice.
Baby knows best.
Negativity's not good for the baby's spirit, really. Do you think?
That was a clip from Prevenge, a new film and directorial debut from writer, director, and star Alice Lowe. You may know her from some of Ben Wheatley's movies, such as Kill List and Sightseers. And the film is notable for a few reasons, and I guess we should just get this out of the way now. She was, I believe, about 7 months pregnant when she starred in the film, and the movie is about a pregnant woman who believes that her unborn fetus is telling her to kill people for specific reasons, motivations that we will not elucidate in this review because that constitutes spoiler territory. All you really need to know is this is a satirical, slightly comic and slightly surreal slasher film about a killer pregnant lady. and possibly a killer fetus. And that's all we're going to tell you premise-wise for now. Matt, I'm going to start with you as our guest of honor. Did you see this movie at sort of at our behest, or was this something you already knew about?
No. I mean, Ricky knows that I'm very much the hardcore genre guy. So I actually caught this at the Toronto International Film Festival when it premiered. And I mean, this was like one of the first on my list. I made sure I saw it like in the theater, no stupid screeners. And it really didn't disappoint. And, you know, to your point, she was there actually doing the Q&A and she had her baby in the crowd. So it was just this surreal moment of really taking in the fact that she was pregnant while she's doing all these scenes of like, you know, some of it's more intensive. It's not just a woman walking around. Like, she gets into it in a few scenes, and having the baby there and, you know, her laughing, like looking at the child, like, my baby's not a demon, I promise. But like, just little anecdotes about that. So yeah, no, this was very much, I saw it at Toronto and I actually watched it again this morning on my Shudder account just so I could refamiliarize myself with it.
Yeah, we should state to people that you will need a Shudder account to see the movie, at least for now. I would assume it will appear elsewhere.
Yeah, I don't know what Shudder's doing about like Blu-rays and stuff like that yet, because they're so new to the exclusivity game. So, like you just said, as of now, you need to, you know, see it on Shudder. But I'm sure like Scream Factory or some company like that eventually will start doing Shudder Blu-rays.
Yeah, I wonder if it's not possible to see like via some other service in other countries. But anyway, so yeah, just that small caveat to get out of the way. So clearly, you're a fan. Ricky, I know that we've been hunting because, you know, the last few weeks we've really been doing a lot of Hollywood films. We've been I think you and I have both been sort of craving something a little bit more on the nasty independent side. Were you sated with Prevenge? Did this do the trick for you?
Yeah, man, I love this movie. I watched it twice.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, man. I love it when you discover these movies. Like, I know, like, Alison Lowe is a pretty big name at this point. Like, a lot of people know her from, like, Sightseers.
Alice,
sorry. She's also done some, like, TV work. You know, and I like Ben Wheatley. Like, I like Kill List, for example. I'm not sure if I like this as much as Kill List, but I think I like this more than most of his movies. Matt, you mentioned that, like, you know, she is pregnant in the movie, and she does get, like, really physical. And so I knew she was pregnant while filming the movie before watching the movie. And so there's one scene towards the end where she gets into this like physical fight with a lady, and it gets like pretty intense. And I was like, holy cow, she was filming this while she was like 8 months pregnant. That's like amazing. So she directed it. She wrote it. You know, she stars in it. I love the soundtrack. It has like this great 80s synth score.
It's so Carpenter. I mean, like, in my review and whatnot, I bring up Carpenter a lot because it really does feel like it, in the way it has like the social message, in like really gritty practical effects that look really good too. She pulls off some nasty practical effects, especially with DJ Dan, and it's 100% not a debut feature. I mean, it is one, but it just doesn't feel like one.
I love this movie. You know, I'm actually writing up, I'm writing a review of the movie, but I'm writing an article about the best movies about pregnancy and horror. And there's so many good ones. Like, I mean, Rosemary's Baby was released in 68, and that was like a huge, massive success. Not only is it, I think, a masterpiece, but it went on to even win like Academy Awards, right? But ever since Polanski's 1968 masterpiece, there's been so many movies revolving around pregnancy and horror. And I'm not just talking about like killer kids, like, for example, The Children and or
The Omen,
yeah.
Children,
but like,
of the Corn.
But it's funny because 1968 was like the year that gave us Rosemary's Baby and Night of the Living Dead. And those two movies sort of like launched this or opened a door to all of these great zombie films and these great movies about pregnant women in horror films. You know, you think of like Inside, the French extreme horror film.
Yeah, you do.
I think that's the first one you think of. It's not even Rosemary's Baby. It's Inside. And that scene I'm referring to where she gets physical, I mean, it's not on the same level as Inside because that movie is like intense and brutal. But, you know, it kind of reminded me a lot of Inside, that specific scene. But there's also like the French film Baby Blood. I don't know if you guys have ever seen it.
I don't think I have, no.
It's really bad, but I recommend you guys watch it. And actually, this morning I was watching Inseminoid. And that is like a cheap, low-budget knockoff of Alien, where they go to outer space and one of the crew members gets pregnant with the alien, and the alien's telling this person to kill the entire crew. It's like one of those movies that you just like, it's so bad, but it's good because you can't help but laugh at the bad acting. Like, the actors are actually reading their lines off of like clipboards and stuff. So I don't know. And so I was thinking about it. I'm like, it's such a good subgenre of like horror. Like there's so many. I mean, I wouldn't put it at the top of my list, but like, you know, like there's a movie I'm trying to think of right now at the top of my head. I can't, something like very similar, like, oh, that's it. It's Alive. Like, you know, if I were Larry Cohen's It's Alive is one, not, first of all, one of the greatest horror films ever made. The thing about It's Alive is that the baby's actually born halfway through the film. So it turns into like a different kind of film where this film is really focused on this lady who is pregnant, right? But yeah, there's just, the point is there's so many good ones. But I love this film, and it was made in 9 days, guys. 9 days. So it's got this great soundtrack. It's got a great score, because even the soundtrack is pretty kick-ass, right?
I assume you mean shot in 9 days.
It was shot in 9 days, right.
That I was going to say.
That would be crazy. You never know, man. You never know. It's got great cinematography, and I love the montage that we get that starts off the third act. Like, it's just a great bit of editing work.
The yoga kind of zone out.
Yeah, and you get, like, these flashbacks to her past and her boyfriend slash, I think, husband, and then the people who she's killed, and...
the creepy crawlies.
Yeah. So, this movie, I love it, guys. I've seen it twice. I highly recommend anyone who listens to this podcast, you clearly love a genre film, check it out. Find a way to watch it if you can. It's really, really good.
Yeah, this movie rules. Do either of you, Matt, do you have any kids by any chance?
I do not.
Okay.
Do not.
I don't
do
either.
Not,
no. Thank God. But no, no offense to anyone with children. But I just wouldn't wish that on myself or small versions of me on the world. I have a close friend who recently gave birth. I actually wanted her on this podcast so that she could, tell us about how this movie might reflect sort of the pregnancy experience. Unfortunately, the timing didn't really work out, but I just kept thinking of her while I was watching this movie because, you know, I had a conversation with her about a few weeks ago, and she couldn't sleep. It was late at night, and she couldn't sleep because the baby was doing, I don't know, something or other, vomiting, farting, whatever, and she was saying, you know, like I really want to finish my doctorate, and there's all these things I wanted to do, but you know, ever since the baby came, you know, I just feel like my priorities and my values have completely realigned. Is this weird? And I told her, well, no. Like, that's absolutely, like, from what I understand, the most normal thing that happens when you have a baby. That's, like, absolutely the most normal thing in the world. And it's just this thing that we all accept. And this movie really makes hay out of the fact that it's not something that's discussed a lot in movies. You know, the radical reorientation that that having a kid sort of naturally forces upon you, and also like just the bizarreness of pregnancy itself, and how, you know, we're meant to think of it as, you know, a miracle and this really beautiful process, and women do, you know, I've heard from people who have been pregnant, you know, something they really enjoy and treasure, but it's not necessarily that way for everyone, and it's telling that, you know, I mean, there's also sorts of logistical reasons, but for all these movies about, you know, cursed pregnancies and demonic babies and all this stuff, this is the first one, to my knowledge, to actually feature an actual pregnant person. And obviously, you need, like, certain circumstances to be just right for that to work. Like, for instance, your head creative being the pregnant person and sort of willing to take that on. But it's such a great, I don't want to call it a novelty. It is kind of a novelty in the sense that it's the only film to ever do it. But it isn't just that. Like, it really adds something to the proceedings. And it also helps that the movie itself, even if she hadn't really been pregnant, would totally still stand up to scrutiny because it is so fun. It's very, very funny and dry in a very particularly British way. The practical effects are a riot, particularly in the DJ Dan sequence, which it's funny. When I was talking to my friend about potentially being on this podcast, I did warn her, you know, the movie is quite graphic, and she's like, I gave birth. And I'm like, oh yeah, but
you've seen this before.
So, but you know, you actually bring up a good point because I think the reason why it works so good in horror is because when you think of someone having a child, you think of them being happy, and it's a cause for hope and celebration. And so it's nice to juxtapose that against something horrific. And the way filmmakers are riffing off of the positives of someone giving birth or being pregnant, and then mixing in with the fears, like, it just, I don't know, it really hits home. And like, we cannot look at a pregnant woman on screen and feel more tense than we would normally feel if we just looked at anyone who wasn't pregnant. You know, it's the same as, like, I think, like, when I watch a horror film and I see a lady in peril as opposed to a man, I feel a lot more, like, I feel more stressed out and tense, or at least if it's a character I like, right? And it does help that she is pregnant in the movie. Now, if you don't know this fact, you can watch the movie and it might not make the same impact as us who know this ahead of time, that she was actually pregnant while filming the movie. But still, I think pregnancy in horror films is just, like, it's like, you know, maybe it's not as popular as, say, the slasher genre. But I think if you do, like, account of how many movies they've made and how many of them are actually, like, really good or even average, like a movie like Grace, for example, which I really like. I don't think it's great, but I think it's a really good first-time feature. Like, the batting average is really high. Like, normally these movies tend to be really good, if not great. This is one of the best.
I think children are just inherently creepy. I mean, again, you guys mentioned, like, Children in the Corn before, and that's not pregnancy per se. It's a children horror movie, but, like, you know, going even a step before being a child, and, you know, a baby is just a symbol of innocence. It's starting anew. It's, you know, it's a clean slate. So to begin that slate with such a bloody kind of montage and, you know, just to taint everything in such evilness, I think that just makes everything so much more involved for a horror film.
Like, going back to Rosemary's Baby, like, I think what makes that movie work so well is it's the way in which we see Rosemary lose total control of her mind and body. Like, her pregnancy, like Simon says, like, it dramatically alters someone's appearance, their psyche, and their everyday life, right? And we see that happening to her in that movie to the point where she can't even recognize herself at the end of the film. And so we kind of get sort of like the same approach here in Prevenge, where she is mentally breaking down. Like, she's lost. She has no idea what to do. Like, there's one, like, I think my favorite scene in the film is when she kills an innocent man and she has regret and her baby starts making fun of her. She's like, "Oh, you feel sorry." and I love how it ends. She's like, "His name was Josh. Of course you would call the cops." And she's like, "You're right. His name is Josh. Joshes are usually nice people." Like, it was like this, she was finding any excuse whatsoever to not feel guilty about the crimes that she's committing. Mm-hmm. But so anyhow, just like that movie, she adopts sort of like a different persona for each of her murders. When this movie started, did you guys think it was going to be like a hardcore feminist piece?
Maybe.
Because the first two murders, she kills two men, right? She kills, like, the sleazy disco DJ who works at some downscale, like, disco pub. And then I'm not entirely sure what the occupation is of the first guy. Is he, like, a scientist, or does he just sell bugs?
He's an exotic pet trader. That's what I got from him.
Okay. Well, anyhow, so she starts off by killing these two dudes, but, like, I think the third victim is actually a lady.
It's the stay, not the, even the stay-at-home mom. It's the mom, not even a mom. Sorry, it is the career woman who kind of stays in the office all day, and, you know, she says, like, you know, is this really the life you want? Because I don't know, like, is she jealous of that person in a way? Because she's not having a child and her life isn't changing, and, like, this is a top-tier manager who goes on these, like, vacations and weekend getaways and doesn't have to worry about a child coming into her life and changing everything.
The whole thing with the baby talking reminds me of another thing that's weird about parents, parenting, and babies, which is that, you know, in actuality, like, babies in the womb and then babies when they're out for, like, quite a while, like, they see, like, a vague, like, swirl of color and light, and all they hear is just, like, incomprehensible garbage, because that's what their brains are. They're garbage. And yet, you know, if you talk to any parent, and they can't help it, you know, little Kirsty likes the music of the Misfits and the stories of George Saunders. Like, no, she fucking doesn't. It's just, you know, that's you, and you're hoping that you're going to raise a cool kid. And that's totally understandable. Like, I'm not blaming parents for doing that. And in the same way, you know, the protagonist of this movie is, you know, looking to, like, she is convinced that this baby has a developed persona. Like, you know, the midwife tries to tell her, like, you know, like, your baby does not understand English. And she does not respond to that logic. And I think that there's something very real there about how parents, like, there's this uncanny aspect to their young where they can't fully accept that, like, the biological realities, because their own biology doesn't let them.
Yeah, and doesn't Alice Lowe even say, like, no, she doesn't understand. Actually, she's quite articulate. Like, something like that. Yeah. Like, she just completely rejects the notion.
Yeah.
So I think I want to dive into really quickly the fact that, like, you know, you guys talked about Rosemary's Baby, and that's coming from Polanski, which is a male's point of view. And I mean, it's very well done. It's a very well done film that treats both genders equally. But I think the reason why Pre-Venge works so well is, I mean, it would have worked well anyway. It's a well-made movie, as we've, you know, said over and over again. But, you know, this is the female perspective. It is an actual pregnant woman writing and directing and experiencing these kind of emotions as she's making the film. So I think that just brings another connectivity where, you know, it's not a male's take on a pregnant woman. Like, no, this is a pregnant woman's movie. I mean, I didn't know that was a genre, but apparently that is. And I just think that brings so much more to these scenes where it's like an immediate connection. Like, we are immediately in tune with the mother because these are the setups that we're going on, you know, as she's going out and killing people and all these, like, jokes she's making with the baby. Like, it's all very maternal and it's all very unique in the sense of the vision that we're seeing.
There is a method and a reason for her madness. Like, she does go around killing people, which you don't find out till later on in the film. I would say you don't really know what's going on until, like, the final, like, 10 minutes, right?
Oh, see, I disagree, because don't they bring up kind of, like, I'm not going to say anything, I'm keeping it completely, but I thought maybe in the first or second act, it's actually, like, it keeps getting kind of teased little by little. I think I was clued on to it.
Yeah.
It is teased, there are things that are implied, but I think, I can't talk about it right now because I don't want to spoil it for listeners. I don't know. It could be one of those things where we don't, because we have an unreliable narrator, right? Like, it's all in her point of view, like the entire film, and she's clearly gone mad. So we're not entirely sure what's real and what's not, what actually happened. But I think the last 5 minutes gives me, like, a different outlook of what happened to...
Oh, no, everything definitely comes to a head. Everything definitely comes into this moment of clarity where it's like, oh, shit, okay.
There is a point. There is a reason why she is going crazy. It's not because she's pregnant. But so what I like about
Although
the movie...
Although that's not helping, probably.
Well, it's not helping. Yeah, totally. But what I do like about the movie is that it's this meditation and this exploration of anxiety and extreme grief. Like, this woman is grieving.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that one thing, the one aspect of the movie that I don't really like is that I feel like the ending, the culmination with that last scene with the midwife, I felt like that put too fine a point on it of, you know, the character has an epiphany and they actually state sort of what I would call the material reality of her circumstances. And that was a little bit disappointing because I sort of preferred the ambiguity. That being said, it's a very minor complaint.
And again, like, the final shot of the film, I think, is perfect, but it also plays to that same exact point where it's like, did we really need that? Like, the last shot is the definitive, like, no, this is what happened. And it's, you know, I love it. I love her face in the scene and stuff like that. But yeah, it plays to the same thing where there is no ambiguity, where, you know, it kind of erases a little bit of what's happened. But I don't know. I think it all works perfectly. And I think that I argue that the pregnancy does play into it for a large factor, because I think that's what actually sets her in motion. Something happens, obviously, but she finds out about the pregnancy the same day said thing happens. So I think finding out that second thing of the pregnancy is really what throws her off the deep end, because now you have all these maternal fears that wouldn't have been existing, you know, to play with this grief. Like, grief is one thing, but grief plus paranoia plus holy shit equals a Carpenter-esque kind of slasher film, I guess.
Right. Plus there's now an association between the bad thing and the pregnancy.
I got a question. At the end of the film, not the last shot, but before the last shot, when she's on, like, the mountain, is that not, like, an exact same shot from Sightseers filmed in the exact same location in which the two people were in the exact same clothes, or am I just crazy?
I think it's very close. I'm
just curious, is this, like, a sequel to Sightseers?
No, it is not, because...
It almost works, though.
Like, no joke. Google photos of Sightseers and tell me if it's not the same location and if they do not wear the exact same clothes.
Yeah. I mean, hell, it's Alice Lowe, so it makes sense, like, oh, I know this great location, we should use it again.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that even though parts of, like, the outlook of this movie actually do recall Sightseers, you know, I'm imagining the Ben Wheatley directed version of this movie, and it's very, very, very different. It would have been a lot more sort of, like, cryptic and elliptical and honestly probably not as funny, even though his movies can be funny at times.
I was going to say, I don't know, Free Fire is hilarious. I think he still tries to work that humor in there where, like, it'd be a different kind of comedy is what I'd say.
Yeah. I have not seen Free Fire yet. I feel like he would have been Wheatley'd up, basically. And this was, to make it clear, like, this movie is extremely, it feels much more sort of down-to-earth and straightforward and more openly, more sort of loving towards its slasher film brethren. It feels very true to, like, this is a movie that's, like, down and dirty and feels very much of a line with, you know, other slasher films, even though it is obviously coming at certain things from a different perspective. Like, it's not trying to be above slasher films in any way.
No, and I think it enjoys not doing that, too. I mean, there's so many great little shots that Alice Lowe works in. Like, I love when she kills the businesswoman, and the businesswoman, like, you know, she falls face down on this glass kind of, like, conference table, and we immediately go under the table to see, like, the blood spurts, like, on the glass from the reverse side. And, there's just something so unique about the way she's filming this. And then at the same time, you have, like, the disco synth music, and then she's walking down the street. What is the... I think it's, like, in the first act when she's watching that black and white horror movie. What do we know what movie that is?
Dude, that was driving me nuts because there's – oh, my God. We should check Internet Movie Database because sometimes they have the trivia. But because there's so many visual, like, cues and references. There's a Halloween party scene in this movie that's reminiscent of Abel Ferreira's Miss 45. Like they had to have watched that movie before filming it. Of course, we can think of, like, a movie like Basket Case by Frank Henenlotter, which I love Frank Henenlotter movies. If you've never seen any of his movies, check them out. He's a great New York City underground indie filmmaker who does a lot of crazy, like, horror films. There is specific shots that look like they were lifted, say, from, like, Dario Argento's, like, Deep Red. And did you guys notice the subway tunnel scene? Did it not remind you of Possession?
I didn't, like, think of it, but now that you're saying it a little
bit. It's like, I feel like all of these filmmakers shoot in the exact same spots. Like, they have a list of places where you can film, like, where you can easily get a license and, like, are allowed to film, like, a scene for a movie in that specific shot. Because the tunnel in this film looks exactly like the tunnel in Possession.
I have to confess, I still have not seen Possession.
Oh, man, get on it. It's so
good. I know.
So do we know what movie it is?
No, IMDb does not have it.
Man, because I kept thinking of, like, a Jack Hill film, like one of those black and white horror films from Jack Hill, but I doubt it.
And it just works so well, like, the way she's walking down the street mirroring that same crazy person she saw on screen, and she's just walking along with the public, like, arms raised in victory after just killing somebody. And it shows how much she's kind of lost in that moment. And it's so funny, though. Like, the black humor is so British, like you said before, and I don't know, I love the British sense of humor. Like, they just have so much more fun with the really dirty, kind of grimy stuff.
And, like, Alice Lowe has never met a one-liner she doesn't like, because, like, there is not... I'm pretty sure after every single murder in this movie, like, she can't help but crack a joke about, like, oh, we're gonna have to make some cuts, or whatever, like, things like that. It's just, like, she didn't need to, but I'm glad that she didn't restrain herself. The other thing about her being pregnant that I think we can't overlook is that, you know, as a society... we associate, you know, fertility and pregnancy with virtue and with frailty and with, you know, nurturing both in the sense of the person doing it being a nurturing force and having to nurture that person for, you know, for the state they're in. And the movie really plays with our sort of, like, just seeing her in that state, seeing how pregnant she is, you know, it elicits, you know, sort of almost a physical sympathy that you then have to sort of forcibly decouple yourself from, because she's the predator of this film. She is, you know, just going around straight up murdering folks. And, like, the process of sort of that cognitive dissonance of this is a pregnant woman, and, like, the things that sort of that your brain tells you to think and feel about pregnant people and seeing what she's actually doing is it's kind of like a special effect.
Sorry, I was just agreeing. I have like nothing more to add there. That was a great little way to put it.
Yeah, she's like a cinematic superhero for the horror genre. I love her. I want her to make more horror films. It's a good year for horror again, guys. Like, last year was an amazing year for horror. And this year, we've got amazing movies already, and it's only April.
I know, dude. The Devil's Candy. Not to bring another movie up right now, but...
Oh, you know what? I need to see the director's cut, because I saw the original cut at TIFF, and I heard he re-edited the film, and apparently it's a lot better.
Wait, really? Because I saw it at Fantastic Fest that same year.
Oh, yeah. Well, Simon told me that he changed a lot.
I have not seen the movie yet. But I did read in a review that when it came out on VOD recently, it was a different edit, and I think a shorter edit. There you go. I heard Rick was not a fan.
No, I liked it a lot. I just, you know, it's not the loved ones. That's like one of the greatest horror films ever made. So.
Okay, that's fair. I'm very excited to see it. Have you yet seen Matt? Have you seen I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore?
I indeed have. The minute it came on Netflix, I saw it.
Is it good? I'm hoping it's good.
Yes, I enjoyed it a lot. I'm going to say it's definitely a certain kind of film. Like, did you ever see Bobcat Goldthwait's God Bless America?
I have not, but I feel like I've seen others of his movies, and I feel like I know exactly what to expect from that one.
Okay, because the way I keep describing it is like a more restrained kind of indie take on God Bless America that kind of, it substitutes the overt destruction against America with a little more storytelling. But it's still just this angsty, like, in the first 5 minutes, it's Melanie Lisinski just basically taking in how shitty humanity is. So, I mean, if you kind of agree with the fact that society's fuck all right now, it is so just kind of angry and overstated and kind of does it in a really nice way that bundles it with the kind of under America, like... I don't know. There's a whole genre right now with like Jeremy Saulnier's Green Room, and you have Blue Ruin, and now you have like Macon Blair making movies like I Don't Feel Home in This World Anymore. Small Crimes at South by Southwest just premiered, and it's the same kind of like Americana twist where you go to these places that you wouldn't really think about, like a coal mining town or something like that, and just find like the kind of people that have given up on life, and it's just a different viewpoint that Hollywood doesn't deal with, but I'm really happy that these indies are like going there, and I don't know, they're bringing back like a relatability to kind of these indie movies.
You're right that Hollywood films don't really address these things, but now we're totally off track here. It was a totally worthy diversion, because now I'm even more excited to see that movie. I think one of the masterstrokes of the movie is the fact that what you would think would be the climax of the movie, which does not really play out the way that you're expecting, takes place at Halloween, which they take ridiculous advantage of, and I think results in some of the most unsettling moments. And her costume, or I should say just makeup, is incredible. I just wanted to mention that. Is there anything else we wanted to mention or single out for praise or damnation?
I want to single out, again, we've talked about the effects, but I really do want to single out the effects 100% here, because, again, it's a debut feature, but it 100% goes practical. You're not getting in that bullshit CGI, and it's all done very well. I mean, again, the DJ dance scene, I don't want to reveal it, but it is probably going to end up on my end of year, like, most of disturbing list, just because of what falls out of him and the way he just looks at it. I'm going to leave it there. Yeah, subtlety, I'm just going to leave it there. But no, I really want to single out the effects and obviously Alice Lowe's performance, because, you know, this is a punishing little prenatal revenge movie and everyone should fucking see it.
Yeah, I should also just state that it's not as gory as like maybe we're trying to make it out to be. Like, that specific scene is really gory, but the odd thing is that scene is actually funnier than it is like disgusting because of something that happens during the scene. Like, there's a third character who we get to meet. I'm so glad we reviewed this film. I mean, if you want to watch a really good horror film about a pregnant woman who's actually pregnant in the movie while filming it, while acting, who commits like cruel acts of graphic bloody violence against a bunch of people, that might sound silly, but trust me, it's really good. Like, this is essential viewing for anyone who's a horror fan.
Yeah, and I mean, like, female filmmaker, let's just do that one more time. Female writer, female director, female star. Let's get more of these, because this is what happens.
Well, there's a bunch lately, right? There's a lot of ladies making horror films these days.
This year, already, I mean, I can go down my list and I can see, like, Raw,
Oh, I really need to see Raw.
Yeah, but I mean, even the first 2 weeks of the year, we had an Underworld movie and The Bye Bye Man, which I'm not saying were good, but those were two mainstream titles directed by females. So, like, we can't ignore the fact that it's been a hell of a year for that stuff. And again, I mean, you have, did you guys see The Lore?
No, but there's also XX, the horror anthology film. Yeah.
I keep hearing The Lore is amazing, but I'm...
Oh my God, The Lore is so good. It's kind of cannibalistic mermaid killer musical.
Still want to know what movie's playing in the background. I keep thinking of like Mario Bava or Jack Hill. I gotta find out, but so far no luck. I've been doing my my Google research while you guys have been talking, and I can't figure it out.
Yeah, if any of the listeners figure this out, please tweet at us so we can sleep at night.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, obviously, you know, I think we described the movie, and I think within 3 minutes of us talking about it, I think you knew whether or not you were interested. But hopefully the following 35 minutes help to persuade you.
Man, even the title card is great. The title card is fantastic. Like,
yes.
I went back to school and I did web development, and we did a lot of Photoshop and graphic design. And I was looking at the title card. Like, I love the font and the colors. And it reminds me of those, like, 70s horror films. Like, even the color yellow that they choose to use. Like, everything about this movie is perfect. From the soundtrack to the look.
They spell the Prevenge to the beat. Like, the beat of the theme is playing. And, like, that it spells Prevenge to that. And it's just...
Especially at the end, it's really, really great. Okay, so the movie's called Prevenge. Alice Lowe, it's great. She's wonderful. This movie is wonderful. And I'm sure she's an excellent mother. So that was Prevenge. I hope everyone goes out to see it, or you know, gets a Shudder account or do what they have to do to see it. And so that's it. We're gonna take a quick break and then come back for a non-film review segment about Ghost in the Shell and whitewashing, because you know people are talking about it. So let's do that in just a moment.
It was completely unnecessary to kill that man. He was really nice.
He was a sop. A hipster sop.
Shh. The sacrifices I've had to make.
What sacrifices?
Children these days are really spoiled. Like, Mummy, I want a PlayStation. Mummy, I want you to kill that man.
I don't want a new...
I know you don't want a new daddy, but there was no possibility of that, so stop going on about it.
He saw everything.
I know he's a witness, but there's a chance he might not have told anyone.
His name was Josh.
No, you're right. No one called Josh is not going to tell the authorities.
Back on Sordid Cinema. So as you may have noticed from our preamble and other discussions, we are not reviewing Ghost in the Shell this week because it sucks and we don't want to do it. Ayo! We decided that would be a waste of everyone's time, including mine and yours, dear listeners. But we did want to spend a little bit of time talking about the, shall we call it, clusterfuck that has developed over the last few weeks, really actually ever since the movie was first announced.
And the only reason why we're doing this is because you and I got into like an hour conversation on the phone yesterday that we should have just recorded, because now we have to do it all over again.
There was levels of fuckery in that conversation that I don't even want to get into, of just like arguments and counter-arguments and details and whatever that listeners don't need to hear. But there is this issue of whitewashing in Hollywood, and what studios can and can't or should be able to get away with, and whether or not they're responsible to their properties and all, and you know, obviously the fans and what they want and blah blah blah. And there's so many thoughts and feelings sort of kicking around. And Matt, I know that you wrote about this issue, and I also know that people had thoughts about you writing about this issue.
Yeah, it wasn't even, you know, I reviewed the film, and, you know, when I review a movie, I review it in the context of a movie. Does it establish the proper themes and storytelling within the, this is 2 hours, right? I think this is a 2-hour movie.
Yeah.
So you had 2 hours to establish Ghost in the Shell and make a case for Scarlett Johansson's casting. and you didn't. I mean, that's my point in the review. My point in the review is, do we want to get into spoilers?
I don't care.
Okay. So basically, I mean, Ricky, confirm with me when you kind of lost it, but I didn't have a problem with ScarJo's casting until the Motoko reveal, because you have Scarlett Johansson and Michael Pitt, who is, again, one of the whitest dudes possible, staring at each other, and they reveal their super Asian names, and they do it, like, with such, like, sincerity of, like, my name is Motoko, and you're like, no, you're, like, just some white bread, like, no, that doesn't work. You don't get to be Scarlett Johansson in the film and also get to keep the Motoko backstory. You have to, like, you know, kind of subvert it a little bit and make it a different background, so you're not just overtly kind of saying, hey, we didn't cast a, you know, Japanese actress, and we're still going to keep Motoko. Like, that doesn't work.
See, so the reason why I was talking to Simon about this, because he asked me about this specific plot point in the film, and I told him that I did not have a problem with her casting, which might piss off a lot of people, but here's the thing. His casting, I had a problem with his casting. There was no reason to put Michael Pitt in that role, because Michael Pitt's not selling the movie. No one's going to the box office to pay $20 to go see Michael Pitt in a secondary role. Like, nobody cares about Michael Pitt, okay? But the thing
sorry,
about Scarlett,
Michael Pitt.
Sorry, Michael Pitt, but we like you and all, but you're not Tom Cruise. Okay, so the point is, though, is that, like, I get it. Like, I was trying to explain this to Simon. Like, you're making this movie, which I'm sure they spent, like, at least $60 to $100 million making, right, in terms of, like, advertising, production costs, et cetera, et cetera. And the fact of the matter is, okay, I understand that people listen to the show, they're movie buffs like us, they, you know, they'll watch movies like Prevenge, but they'll also watch movies like Rogue One. But for the mass audience, the mainstream audience, the people who aren't movie buffs, the people who don't know a director's name, I swear to God, guys, they go see the movie based on the actor. I could tell you about all of these different places I worked, like when I worked at Concordia University alongside all of these older women, you know, as a receptionist at the health clinic, and they would go see a movie based on the actor. You know, it's Patrick Swayze, I'm going to go see it. It's Tom Cruise, I'm going to go see it. They have no idea who the director is, who the cinematographer is, who the writer is. They have no idea if the movie's adapted from a bookend or not.
Everyone went out and saw Lucy. It killed the box office, and that was a ScarJo random sci-fi actioner.
Exactly. Scarlett Johansson, like, you know, you could say that she's one of the reasons why that movie was a box office success. But the point I'm trying to make here is I didn't have a problem with her casting, because they still included a lot of Asian actors in the movie, like beat Takashi Kitano's in it, right?
And they do walk through it.
Yeah, well, he's wasted, but at least they do speak their language, and they do at least try to address why Scarlett Johansson is cast in the movie. Like, she is Asian, like, she's Asian, but when she's reconstructed and built, they just, for whatever reason, decide to use a white lady's face. So the thing is, we know the reason. The reason is because you're making a Hollywood film that costs a shit ton of money. You want to make sure you make the money back. And so as an investor, as someone who's putting money into this movie, like, you know, like, you, I mean, do you blame, like, you can blame Hollywood to some extent, but you could also just blame society, because the fact is, if it was anyone else, this movie wouldn't have made as much money.
I mean, I agree with what you are saying, Ricky. And actually, that is the comment that someone left on my review. It is a very lengthy comment calling me a racist because I'm demanding some kind of Japanese representation in Major's casting. And again, like, I didn't have an issue. I wasn't one of the first people saying whitewashing. Like, when that was going around, just based on people's thoughts and not seeing the movie, I was like, no, I don't think you're allowed to be mad at that, because we don't know the creative interpretation that's going to be taken. After seeing the movie, I think it's horrendous. And the fact that, like, one of the last scenes is literally Scarlett Johansson standing on Motoko's grave, just staring at it, just kind of like a big fuck you, kind of like, in the fact of, I'm Scarlett Johansson standing on Motoko's grave, and I don't give a shit.
Okay, like, you're a Hollywood producer, right? You're investing your money into this movie, much like you open a restaurant, you're investing your money into this restaurant. And, you know, like, you need it to be a success. You know, because you might go bankrupt, for example. Do you blame, like, I mean, who do you blame? Do you blame the filmmakers, the writer, the director, the Hollywood studio? Because they want the movie to make money. And the fact is, like, what I'm trying to explain to Simon is, like, the bottom line is, especially in North America, most people go see movies based on the actor. That is a fact. So if anything, blame fucking society.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, I'm not even blaming anyone here. I'm just looking at the film as itself and saying, like, I, like, it doesn't pull off what it wants to do. Or no, sorry. I shouldn't say that. I take that back as well. It doesn't pull off what it wants to do because it's a boring as fuck movie and it doesn't deserve anything. Also, I agree with you. I am not the first person to say, like, you know, Iron Fist, the same shit. Like,
I was just going to bring up Iron Fist.
I mean, it's the same thing where, again, you need to make money as a producer. And Scarlett Johansson's going to make you money. I 100% agree with that. I 100% agree with the fact that it just had to happen. But in the same respect, you have to change the story. You have to be thinking of all kind of aspects here, and you have to be aware of the fact that you're going to piss people off. If you do it wrong, you're going to be called out for certain things. But then as I'm saying this, I guess if I'm a producer, I don't give a shit about them. Yeah. I really only give a shit about the money.
Well, the thing about this movie is that it is a sci-fi film, right? It takes place in this dystopian future. And, you know, yeah, it's mishandled and the movie's just a complete mess. But I do think at least the writer or the director, I'm not sure who to credit, did try to justify the casting of Scarlett Johansson because she, like I said, she is Asian in the film. Like, she's Asian. Like, she might not look Asian because her body was reconstructed, but she's clearly Asian. There's a scene where she goes and visits her mom, and her mom is Asian, right? It's a problem, but I don't think it's on the level of, like, The Last Samurai or Memories of a Geisha, where they actually cast someone, like Tom Cruise, who's playing, like, this Japanese samurai, but he's not at all Japanese. At least, like, I don't like this movie, and I'm not trying to defend the movie. I do think it's mishandled. But I feel like, okay, it's clearly a problem across Hollywood. It's something that people have been talking about for a while now, but I still do, like, blame society in general. And so Simon asked me a question. This is how the conversation started yesterday when we were talking on the phone. Is there a movie, like a Hollywood blockbuster, that doesn't have a big name attached to it, like it doesn't have like a Tom Cruise or Scarlett Johansson starring in it, that they spent a lot of money on and actually made a lot of money at the box office? Like, if you look at something like John Carter, like if John Carter, which flopped for Disney, they spent a shit ton of money on that movie. If that movie had starred, say, Tom Cruise,
Hold on. That wasn't my question. I was... Because
okay, well, hold on. I guarantee that movie would have made a lot of money if it started Tom Cruise. What was your question?
Okay, the line of inquiry that I had was: does it matter if the movie is any good or not? Because like Lucy was you know, as far as I know, an original screenplay. It was it was a very, very high concept, came out in a busy season, and even though it wasn't based on a property people knew about, it made shitloads of money. And it happened to have Scarlett Johansson in it. Now, the thing about Lucy is that Lucy kicked fucking ass, as far as I'm concerned. And I think that probably audiences agreed. And it made a lot of money.
But it had Scarlett Johansson. She's huge. She was in The Avengers, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, but she starred in this movie, which was a known property, high concept, and, you know, very, very much promoted on her looks and, you know, her athleticism and all this shit. And it completely belly flopped. So maybe it matters that movies suck sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, we don't, you know, as journalists or whatever you want to call us, like film critics or whatever, like, I don't know. I never think that my opinion matters in a way. But for something like this, with just so much of the whitewashing controversy and stuff like that, and seeing it bomb this hard, like, I don't know. It almost makes me think, like, some of these kind of pre-conversations and whatnot that can kind of, like, take the wind out of the sails of a movie, like, I don't know. Maybe it is possible that all this negativity surrounding Ghost in the Shell kind of put like this shadow over it that really kind of scared people away. And it's a strange thing to me because no, I agree with you. I don't recall a movie off the top of my head that starred all, you know, newcomers, got hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, there's Star Wars, you know, the Matrix. Yeah. Keanu Reeves wasn't like a household name when he made the Matrix, but movies like that, they're special.
I would say Reeves was a pretty big name.
But here's the thing, guys. Look at the box office. Number one at the box office was The Boss Baby. Number two was Beauty and the Beast. Now, okay, first of all, Beauty and the Beast, maybe it's a good movie. Haven't seen it, but it's also a remake of an animated film that's beloved. And The Boss Baby, I seriously doubt that movie is very good.
Yeah, but family films always make...
So that family is films number one at the box loads. Office, Simon, and that's not a good movie, so...
Yeah, but family... Okay, question, okay, hold on.
That's... Children's movies do not count in this, because you can almost always bank on the fact that a children's movie is going to top the box office no matter what is no matter what it's opening against, or no matter what season it is.
Yes, because families, all they see is they look at the rating, like, oh, it's G rating, good, we can see it. And I would say the other exception is superhero movies. Your superhero movie can suck so bad, like Suicide Squad. I assume I haven't seen it. I'm just going to assume it sucks because it's fucking Suicide Squad. And your movie is going to make shitloads because it's got a bunch of villains in it and comic book fans are idiots. Okay, they're not all idiots, but they will all apparently see Suicide Squad.
But not all superhero movies actually make a lot of money at the box office. Suicide Squad was a special case. I don't know if you know this. Suicide Squad was re-edited after the movie was done by the trailer company.
Yeah, I remember.
Right? So, and like movies like Suicide Squad and Deadpool, like, I actually think there's great marketing behind those movies. Like, the marketing is more interesting than the actual movie, I think. But I don't know. Going back to your question, I don't know why this movie tanked. I mean, Scarlett Johansson does star in it. It had, I think, some pretty decent advertising. Like, I like the marketing campaign. I like the trailer to cut. I like the posters that they designed. It only made $20 million at the box office.
Yeah.
I think with a property like Ghost in a Shell, when right away you get negative buzz online, like a week prior, like 2 or 3 days prior, all of the fans of the original material are not going to go run and see the movie at the box office. So you did eliminate about, I don't know, like 25% of your audience. You know, that movie, if it was good, it could have doubled the amount of money made at the box office. But here's the thing, Simon. So to answer your question, finally, before we end the podcast. Now, this is opening weekend. I'm looking at the numbers for like the first 2 or 3 days. Now, there is a good chance that some people read a review of Ghost in a Shell on Thursday or Friday, because I believe there was an embargo on the review, right? The thing is that I think, like, the world's changing nowadays, especially with the internet. Like, the younger generation is more in tune as to what's going on in the world of, like, arts, film, comic books, movies, TV shows, whatever. It's like everyone who has a laptop and the internet knows who's directing what these days. Like, that's why we have thousands of blogs that actually are successful. And so it's a whole different time. So I think things are going to change, and for the better, in the next 5 years, because I think Hollywood is looking at what people are saying online and they're actually taking in the feedback. Like, they're taking it seriously. And so there are still some, you know, studios and Hollywood producers who are not willing to take the risk. But this movie was also backed, if I'm not mistaken, by Paramount. And I wouldn't be surprised if that company does not exist in the next 5 years. Can you name all of the Paramount movies that are coming out this year? Yeah. They have Transformers.
Transformers is going to make them all their money back this year.
I mean, here's the thing. What's happening now is that I think the real reason that Ghost in the Shell tanked is that nerd culture is now mainstream culture. And, like, nerd/geek culture is steering the ship, which is why you have the Marvel Cinematic Universe existing at all, and B, making all the fucking money in the universe. And studios are paying attention. But the inverse of that is that if you do a thing and it doesn't say to the nerdverse for one reason or another, such as, for instance, adapting this property and, you know, and let's say, for the sake of argument, whitewashing it, you know, you stand to alienate the people who will be doing a lot of the heavy lifting for getting people to go see it. I don't think it's about any individual reviews. I don't think it's even about film critics. I think it's just it's about the discussion. It's about how people get excited for things. And I think honestly, as soon as they cast it, it was doomed. I think as soon as they committed to that, no matter what the execution was, maybe if it had been a little better, that you know, they would have had a slightly more success. But, you know, I mean, the inverse of this is that because the nerdverse steers things now, we're going to get a million superhero movies until the end of time, and, you know, a million Star Wars movies. They're now planning, like, 9 Alien movies.
Whoever's in charge of making this movie, like, whoever decided to cast Scarlett Johansson and finance the thing, they're kind of, like, idiots, because if they had actually put an Asian actor in the lead, maybe they wouldn't have made a lot of money at the box office, but, hey, it didn't do very well. Anyhow, but they could have made a ton of money overseas. And whenever a movie gets released in China, that movie makes a shit ton of money. Because you know why? There's only like 12 American movies released in China per year. Like, look at World of Warcraft.
Yeah, and you have to know that a Chinese company also did Ghost in the Shell. It wasn't just Paramount. I'm looking it up really quickly right now. But it was another Chinese production company that did this. So it's going to get a full release in China. Mm-hmm. We also have to remember that. And I mean, you mentioned Warcraft, and I mean, we're going to get a Warcraft sequel because of how well it did internationally.
Right, but Matt, here's the question for you. So, but why did they not just cast... I mean, I've already said why, but they could have taken the risk. They could have taken the risk and cast Asian actors. Like, imagine if, like, Donnie Yen was in the movie or something, right? And taking the risk, maybe it would have done better in North America, and they would still have the Asian market.
Yeah, and I think the last point I want to make, and it goes along with like the nerd culture in a way, but you know, it is our society as a whole now. We are run by kind of like the social justice warriors, and you know, that is the current internet voice of social media and whatnot. Where I can tell you, you know, a ton of critics and journalists off the top of my head that the minute Scarlett Johansson was cast, as you said, this movie was doomed to them. Like, they were never going to give it credit, and they were always going to be going on about, like, you know, the casting and whatnot, because it was ScarJo and because it wasn't, you know, racially balanced, we'll want to call it. But I mean, that's the times. If this was 10 years ago and the same movie came out with the same cast, let's say Scarlett Johansson didn't age, and you know, this was 10 years ago, I mean, like, no one would be making this kind of a fuss. I mean, go back and watch some movies from the 90s and be like, holy shit, how do we, like, get away with this? Like, imagine doing this in today's world. Even stuff like watching something like Blazing Saddles and looking at what Mel Brooks was able to get away with, and you go, like, oh my god, like, the only movie to try something that ridiculous recently has been, like, Get Hard. And it really was pretty tame about some of its pretty overt racial humor. But, you know, it just got destroyed because it was like, oh my god, I can't believe they're doing this. That's the world we live in now. Like, this is what we are. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you have these, you know, these megabucks assholes who are like, oh, you're surprised that these people don't have the fucking finger on the pulse? Like, of course they don't. Like, they pay other people to tell them what the zeitgeist is. And it's those people who really fucked up and, you know, and just said, yeah, that's a good idea. Because they're the ones who really should have known better. So yeah, and
but again, they didn't care. You know, this goes back to Ricky's point. Really, maybe they didn't give a shit because again, they're trying to make money. That's what they're trying to do.
Yeah, they're trying to make money. You can't blame them for trying to make money because they're investing money. And regardless if it's right or wrong to whitewash these characters and actors in like movies, I mean, the bottom line is it's a bigger problem that reaches further than just the guys who are throwing money at the movies. Yeah. It's a problem in society in general. I mean, look, if you look at movies like The Raid, for example, which is like one of the greatest action movies made in the past 10 years, would The Raid have made as much money as John Wick if it had the same distribution deal, if it was playing in as many theaters across North America and advertised as heavily as John Wick? We don't know. Maybe not. But I'm willing to bet that it wouldn't have made as much money as John Wick, just because it didn't have Keanu Reeves.
And I mean, Dredd didn't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's it.
As always, the real enemy is capitalism.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if we actually answered anything, but we talked some stuff.
But we sure did enjoy hearing ourselves talk. Yeah, I forget who tweeted this, but someone said, I was asked what a podcast is, and I answered, well... When two or more people love themselves more than anybody else. Anyway, thank y'all for listening so much. This is a great discussion. Matt, where can people find you online?
Yeah, you can find me. Well, you can find my writing on either WeGotThisCovered.com or Film Journal International, or you can just follow along at Donato Bomb on both Instagram, Twitter, and all those social medias, and you can be up to date with my life.
Fantastic. I am on the Twitters at HollowMinds, but don't follow me because I'm going to yell at you probably. Ricky, you run Goomba Stomp Mag and the Sorted Cinema Twitter handles. And do visit Sorted Cinema and rate, review, subscribe, do all the nice things that you can do on iTunes because the podcast is 100% free. Thank you all so much for listening. We'll be back next week. Woo!
To do this, hands warmed up. My mom taught me this. Don't learn that at college. Okay, I'm just gonna press here down the side. There you go. Oh, there you go.
She doesn't like that.
I'm just feeling for the head.
Well, it's in this area. It's in the stomach area. Even I know that.
Yeah.
Don't worry, she's got a head. She's thinking all the time, a bit too much.
We discussed blood pressure, didn't we, last time?
to monitor your blood pressure. So, are you looking after yourself? Eating well? How are you sleeping?
Well, she's not really letting me sleep, so...
No?
No.
And that's affecting your mind, your rationality. Just have to make a few notes, you see. I have to monitor this. It's my job to keep track of everything.
What do you mean?
Well, if there's anything untoward or anything difficult occurring, I need to get in touch with social services.
No.
Shake me. I'm fury.